Today is Tuesday, September 22nd, and this is Kathy bringing you news from the Decatur area. This particular article was just popped up just as very quickly. Fatal crash causes long delays near Salem School Road. Just 43 minutes ago, it's about 10:30 now. Illinois State Police troopers responded to a crash today with a reported fatality injury on U.S. 36 near Salem School Road. The crash involves a semi-tractor trailer and a passenger automobile. The accident has caused a complete shutdown of traffic at Salem School Road and the railroad tracks north of U.S. 36. Expect extended delays while the crash is being reconstructed by the state police. Motorists should use an alternate route until noon, according to the news release. This story will be updated, possibly before we're off the air. Robertson students march for peace. This article was just posted by Valerie Wells, HR staff writer. Students at Robertson Charter School are too young to remember We Are the World, the single by USA for Africa, a supergroup of some of pop music's biggest stars, which raised money to combat famine. But they learned the song and sang it together Monday. "You're not old enough to understand the power of this song," Principal Cordell Ingram told the students. From kindergarten through fifth grade, who marched around the Law Enforcement Center and the Macon County Courts facility in celebration of United Nations International Peace Day. "But you being here today is making it a better day." Last year, student Torion Howard came up with the idea for the march, but there wasn't time to organize it, said fifth grade teacher Marvell Manns. "He decided that as a child he could make a difference," she said. "The voices of peace are all going to come from the children." Students arrived by bus and gathered for a march around the block, carrying signs with messages such as, "We want to grow up," "Stop the violence," "All lives matter," and "Give peace a chance." The largest banner, which took four students to carry, read, "We solve problems fully." They chanted, "Peace, love, we're coming together," as they walked and gathered on the court's facility steps for a short rally afterward. "We're talking about peace all around the world," Ingram said. "It starts in our own community." "The children should think about the unrest and war in other parts of the world," he said, "and be thankful every day that they're Americans, free of fear of war at their own doors," though he added that Decatur has had its share of violence in the streets. Macon County Sheriff's Deputy Elgin Hawthorne, who accompanied the kids as they walked, told them that the pathway to world peace begins in their own hearts, and he tapped his chest as he spoke. "It starts within yourself," he said. Takia Bond, a fifth grader, read a speech about how her mother told her peace begins with the simple gesture of a smile. "But today, at this very moment, on International Day of Peace and America, if we as a nation could show an ounce more of love and understanding, we as a people would be that much closer to peace," said Murley Carson, also a fifth grader. This headline reads, "All-Female Sound Celebration Chorus Tunes In to Love of Music." This is by Tony Reed from Springfield. The Sound Celebration Chorus is sounding its way through some vocal calisthenics as it works out the kinks in the 1942 Johnny Mercer classic, That Old Black Magic. Listening to the massed voices stop, start, and refine their approach before hitting their stride and pulling sweet harmonics out of thin air, it's clear these distaff singers already know some magic of their own. The Sound Celebration Chorus is a group of 38 female vocalists who perform without instruments. They belong to an organization called Sweet Adelines International, and they are basically a female version of the traditional male bastion of the barbershop a cappella singing style. The singers meet at the Hoagland Center for the Arts in Springfield for rehearsals every Monday night, and their membership ranges in age from the 80s to 14-year-old Sarah Bodecker from Decatur. "I've always loved singing," says the Lutheran School Association eighth grader. "I don't like playing instruments, but my voice is the best instrument that I know, and that is what I am sticking with." She passed her audition and recently joined the chorus, and her grandmother, Elizabeth Hardcastle, has just completed her audition, too. Hardcastle was a member of a former quartet called Ambiance that won major competition honors with the Sweet Adeline International. "She doesn't want to appear overconfident about her audition. This isn't the voice I had years ago," she says, "but it's hard to imagine she's sweating it too much." Her granddaughter fell in love with what a voice could do after growing up watching videos of Ambiance performances. "There's a lot of camaraderie to the singing, and once you get through the dogma of training and training and training well, when it comes together, it just sparkles," said Hardcastle, 69, who also lives in Decatur. I guess it's the way for athletes when the endorphins hit, when they are running. Singing together is an incredible high. And it's getting more intense. Sound Celebration traces a history of success back more than 60 years, but hit a higher note in April when it won the small chorus division of the Sweet Adeline's Region 5 competition in Iowa. The chorus score was so good, it also finished in second place overall and qualified for the Sweet Adeline's Harmony Classic International Competition in Las Vegas in October of 2016. That means we are competing with the very best in the world, said Martha Eider, another Decatur woman who is a former director of the chorus, and we're going to feel really good if we win that. The chorus singers seem to feel pretty good most of the time already, constantly uplifted by their ability to push themselves to make sounds that give each other goosebumps. A tough training and practice regimen means members must copy songs to work on at home, with the Monday practices the opportunity for fine-tuning and adjustment. The only guy inside is Terry Ludwig, the chorus director, who is a firm believer in the principle that the road to perfection is paved with practice. The more work you put in, the better it gets, and the more fun you have, says Ludwig, 47, who directs a barbershop chorus Tuesday nights. So yeah, we work hard. We absolutely work hard. A little sweat equity in her singing doesn't faze die-hard performers such as Carol Johnson from Oriana. A member of the chorus since the early 1980s, she doesn't get off work from her registrar job in a Decatur medical office until 7 p.m., and then she heads straight over to Springfield to catch what she can of the Monday rehearsals. Why do I do it? Because I love it, she said. Headline reads, Man Fighting for Life After Being Punched in the Head by Tony Reed. A sworn police statement reveals details of the alleged unprovoked assault that has left a Decatur man fighting for his life in hospital. The victim had just turned 26 on Sunday when patrol officers responding at 1:16 a.m. to 911 calls of a fight in progress found him moaning in pain on the ground in the 1900 block of East North Street. He remained in critical condition Monday after being flown to St. John's Hospital in Springfield. A 35-year-old man is being held in the Macon County Jail on a preliminary charge of an aggravated battery. A sworn statement filed by Police Detective Adam Jarris said the severity of the victim's injuries had quickly become apparent when he was first seen by doctors at St. Mary's Hospital. St. Mary's Hospital staff determined that the victim had a brain bleed and that his brain had shifted in his skull, Jarris wrote. Doctors at St. Mary's stated that the victim's injuries were life-threatening and the victim was airlifted to St. John's Hospital. The victim underwent brain surgery and is now being looked after in the St. John's Intensive Care Unit. Detectives working on the case interviewed witnesses who said the victim had not been involved in the fight but was just standing there and done nothing to provoke the attack. Those witnesses also identified the suspect who lives in the area and described how he had punched the victim in the face, causing him to fall over and hit his head on concrete. Witnesses stated that the victim fell to the ground and his body began to shake and convulse uncontrollably, Jarris wrote in the statement. According to police, witnesses were shown a photo lineup and they picked out the suspect, who has a previous conviction for aggravated unlawful use of a weapon. He was arrested Sunday afternoon and is being held in custody in lieu of posting $200,000 bond. He is due to be arraigned September 28th. This headline reads, Boyfriend Accused of Attacking Woman Tearing Off Clothing During Pursuit by Tony Reed. An enraged boyfriend who allegedly ripped his girlfriend's shirt and bra off as he chased her down the street was being held in jail Monday on preliminary charges of aggravated domestic battery. Sworn Decatur police statements allege that the 24-year-old victim had dated the suspect for five months and was living with him in the 500 block of North University Avenue when they got into a row about 10:30 Sunday. That's p.m. In his statement, Patrol Officer Justin Closen said that the girlfriend told him she tried to flee the house, but was chased onto a bed while calling police. It's alleged her $800 phone was smashed by the suspect, who then proceeded to choke her till she began to black out, and he relented. She then did escape the house, but was pursued by the suspect who caught her at the corner of University and Cerro Gordo Streets, grabbing her around the upper body and trying to drag her home. She was able to get away from him, but he pulled off her shirt and bra in the process, Closen wrote in the statement. The woman then ran to a front porch of a house in the 1100 block of West Cerro Gordo with the boyfriend still in pursuit. Once on the front porch of this residence, the suspect attempted to grab grab onto her again, but she was able to kick him in the stomach, causing him to fall off the front porch close inset. She was able to flee to another neighbor's residence to call police. Closen encountered the suspect at his home about 11:25 p.m., catching sight of him as he allegedly jumped out a window and fled. He was chased to the 1200 block of West Cerro Gordo, where he suddenly lay down in the roadway in a prone position and was arrested. In addition to the battery charge, the suspect was booked on charges of resisting police, interfering with the report of domestic violence, and criminal damage for allegedly smashing his girlfriend's phone. He remained jailed Monday night in lieu of posting a $125,000 bond. If he makes bail, he is ordered to stay away from his girlfriend and their residence. This headline reads, John Williams settles in as city's transit administrator. From Decatur, by Allison Petty. After John Williams accepted a job as administrator of Decatur's public transit system, Peoria Mayor Jim Artist called Decatur City Manager Tim Gleason. He told me that we had stolen one of his very good employees, Gleason told the Decatur City Council on September 8th. I liked hearing that. Williams, 54, served as Director of Special Services for the Greater Peoria Mass Transit District for almost 10 years before he came to Decatur last month. He replaces Paul McChancy, who retired in June after 16 years on the job. Williams is the lone city employee dedicated to transit. He oversees the firm, currently MV Transportation, that manages the 70 transit employees, including bus drivers. In the past few weeks, Williams said he has gotten to know many employees and was impressed by their commitment and enthusiasm. They would love to see some equipment updates, and what I mean by that is buses, Williams said. Hopefully, sometime in the near future, we can have those things coming in for them. Before he moved to the transportation field, Williams worked as a health educator and youth development coordinator for Planned Parenthood in Peoria. He earned a bachelor's degree in business administration from Robert Morris University in 2010 and a master's of science in management and organizational behavior from Benedictine University in 2014. In addition, Williams was an active volunteer in his former city. He served on the Peoria Housing Authority Board, the Mayor's Advisory Council for the Disabled, and several other committees, and was involved in the Peoria Black Chamber of Commerce. Williams plans to be involved with activities in Decatur, too. As I get a sense of the pulse of the city, I can kind of determine where the needs are for my services and where I would best fit into this community, he said. Decatur City Council welcomes Mr. Funk. In a move expected since it was first revealed last week, the Decatur City Council voted 4-2 Monday night to appoint Chris Funk to serve as its seventh member. He takes the seat formerly held by Julie Moore Wolfe, until she was appointed mayor August 17th to the vacancy created by Mike McElroy's death 1 month earlier. I'm looking forward to continuing the vision the council has already set forth, said Funk, a senior vice president and chief credit officer for Hickory Point Bank and Trust. We have a lot of positive momentum in this community, and I'm looking forward to being a part of it going forward. Funk, 35, was recommended to the position by Councilman Jerry Dawson, who knew Funk while they both served on the Community Investment Corporation of the Decatur Board. Though he has never held an elected position, Funk has served on boards for the Kiwanis Club and Girl Scouts of Central Illinois, and is a current member of boards for Macon Resources Incorporated and Decatur Christian School. Moore Wolfe said after the meeting that Funk has several elements that make him an appealing choice for the council, from his 13 years of experience at Hickory Point Bank and Trust to his relative youth. We need to start growing the next leaders for this community, because some of us are not going to be around much longer in a public setting, Moore Wolfe said. Also, when you look around on the council, we really didn't have a business person, so Chris brings that as a banker. We have smart people on the council, but it's great to bring someone from the business community with a great financial mind. Council members Bill Faber and Dana Ray were the two no votes on the appointment. Faber, who did not attend the closed session interview with the finalists, criticized the process as not being transparent and lacking public input. While the city council might have made the right choice, it did it in the wrong way, McElroy said. Funk and Livingston were two of the four finalists for the appointment, to which the city received 20 applicants. The other finalists included former council members Carla Brinkcotter and Jerry Foster. Brinkcotter served on the council from 1999 to 2003, While Foster served multiple terms from 1977 to 81, 95 to 99, and 2008 to earlier this spring. The finalists were chosen after city council members made their top picks for the appointment. All four candidates were interviewed for the position September 14th by five members of the council in a two-hour closed session. Moore Wolf said the board could not have gone wrong with any of the selections. "We were blessed with a great number of candidates," she said. "Chris was just a phenomenal interview, and I think he brings something different to the council." In other business, the board voted unanimously to go ahead with a consent order with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency that would lead to the city conducting a detailed study of its sewers and making future repairs. The city will contract with AECOM Technical Services to assist in the completion of the order at an expected cost of $456,620. The cost will come out of the sanitary sewer fund, which is supported by the sewer user charge. The order requires the city to provide a comprehensive review of its sewer collection system assets, including system management, maintenance, and capital improvement funding. In addition, it asks the city to have an analysis of areas identified as experiencing sewer backups during storms. If the city were not to comply with the EPA, City Manager Tim Gleason said it could face daily fines totaling in the thousands of dollars. While the study should take several months, Gleason said it is still premature to discuss the overall time frame and cost of the project. Now I'm going to switch over to the Decatur Tribune and Paul Osborne's City Beat, and of course he's going to talk again about Chris Funk, which is okay. City Council unofficially approves Chris Funk to fill the empty council seat. The City Council is expected to approve Funk to fill the seat left vacant when Julie Moore Wolf was appointed mayor last month. Funk's name is on the City Council meeting agenda for Monday night, where it is expected that official approval will be given by the members, and we know that that did happen. This next article from the Tribune, Council appoints new member approves sewer plan. The Decatur City Council once again has a full complement of members following action Monday night, with one of its first orders of business being to approve the next steps to address sewer backups in the city. Council members voted in favor of a resolution to appoint Chris Funk to fill the council seat, vacated by the August appointment of Julie Moore Wolf to the position of mayor. Councilman Funk, who serves as Senior Vice President and Chief Credit Officer for Hickory Point Bank and Trust, was officially sworn in as part of Monday's regularly scheduled Decatur City Council meeting for a term that will extend until the next municipal election in April of 2017. Later in the meeting, members voted to support a negotiated administrative compliance order between the city and the United States Environmental Protection Agency and to authorize a detailed study of the city's sanitary sewer system as part of the order. The steps come following several years of discussion between the city and the EPA over sanitary sewer system backups throughout the community, with originally proposed EPA court action requiring the city to fix the entire system, narrowed to a willingness by the EPA to allow for the addressing of priority areas through a less intensive administrative process in the more immediate future. Members voted to hire AECOM to prepare the necessary sewer system reports for a fee of $456,620. During EPA negotiations, the city was able to show that it had already taken proactive steps to address problems through the creation of both a sanitary sewer master plan and a stormwater sewer master plan, which the existence of which are believed to have helped in gaining administrative compliance order. This is from Paul Osborne's Musing on Life in Decatur's Auto World. "I had to take Christine, my quote-unquote possessed car, to a local dealer so he could fix some defect that the manufacturer warned owners could be a problem. It was something to do with the button that raises and lowers seats that could malfunction. As you know, if you've read some earlier columns about Christine, when it comes to that car, my being ejected through the roof by a possible faulty seat control is the least of my worries. The dealer did a great job correcting the problem, and Christine didn't start up and run out of the garage even once during the procedure. A couple of months ago, I wrote that some drivers hadn't adjusted to driving in the left lane on South Franklin at Wood Street. That's where the new streetscape design has a curb jutting out and blocking that lane, forcing all lanes to angle to the right as they head on through downtown. Some drivers still haven't adjusted. The lane divider lines are not that clear, and when I am driving in the left lane, the driver next to me sometimes thinks I am pulling over into his lane. I've received a few horn blasts and the number one finger sign resulting from some close calls, and I'm the one who's driving in the correct lane. To my knowledge, the finger sign is not something taught in high school driver's training classes. While I'm on the subject of car horns, my previous car that I drove for several years had a horn that never honked. It taught me a lot of patience, and other drivers must have thought I was one of the most polite drivers on the road because I never honked my horn. I've had my present car for about a year, and I've never used the horn except when I bought the car to see if it worked. I guess having a horn that didn't work for so many years trained me not to use my car horn even when it works. I walked over to the Cruise 11 to remember 9/11 event in Central Park Sunday afternoon, and I don't know about anyone else, but those classic car shows give me a real flashback to my teenage years through seeing the same models of cars I once owned. There was a 1955 Chevy that was exactly like the one I had back then. I never gave a thought during those years that someday the cars I drove would be considered classics, whether in car shows, and worth a lot of money. That was back when motorists drove their cars instead of being driven by them with all the warning lights, sounds, and voices going off. Thanks to the guy who recently rescued a damsel in distress when her car's horn wouldn't stop honking, apparently tripped by the security system, in the 100 block of South Water Street, right in front of her office building. After she unsuccessfully tried to stop it from honking, a young man ran over and did something to disable it. The woman gave him a big hug in gratitude. Why didn't I go out and fix her horn? Are you joking? I can't even control my own car. Sirius gave me a free trial program, radio programming for my car, where I could enjoy commercial-free music from one of several channels. The channel I selected was playing Don McLean's American Pie, actually recorded in 1971, when I left the municipal parking garage headed for home, and the song was ending just as I was pulling into my garage at home. That means I listened to only one song on the channel for that whole quote-unquote trip from downtown to the southwest side of Decatur. I'll stick to talk radio. November 1st is an important day for car owners like me. Daylight savings time ends, and for the first time since March 8th, the digital clock in my car will be correct instead of being 1 hour off. Sure, I could adjust the clock when the time changes in the spring, but then I wouldn't have an item to finish this column, and November 1st wouldn't be as special. Big smile. And that was posted on the 18th. Photos of Mayor's office remind me of another time in my life. I was looking for some photos in our files today, and I came across two that were shot on my last day in the Mayor's office at City Hall, a little over 7 years ago. It seems like only yesterday. One of the reasons it doesn't seem that long ago to me is because I've continued to write and speak about City Hall, not only in the City Beat column each week, but also appearing on the City Hall Insider on WSOY's Buyers and Company program for an hour every Thursday morning at 7 a.m. I've been commenting on Brian Byers' program either as mayor or former mayor for the past 12 years. Except for several months between the time I left office and Mike McElroy was elected mayor, for the last 12 years, the two of us maintained a close bond regarding city government, talking and meeting about the mayor's job and issues that confront the city. I was in my sixth year when I left office, and Tuna had just finished his sixth year when he suddenly passed away last month. Over the past 12 years, I've had the opportunity to talk and write about city government from a position that very few editors and publishers experience. I've not only written about our city government for decades from the outside looking in, but also from the inside looking out during the years I served as mayor. There are times in my column that I mention the fact that I was mayor, not to boast, but to point out that the reason I know the background of a particular vote and council actions is because I was there chairing the meetings and dealing with city issues. I don't have to use secondhand information. I was there. Monday, Mayor Pro Tem Julie Moore Wolf was selected by the City Council to be mayor until the election in 2017. Julie has been a friend for many years, and I know she will do an excellent job in the position. Although quite a few people encouraged me to seek the position of mayor again, and also that of an appointed city councilman to fill Julie's seat, I appreciate the confidence, but I have no interest in running for or being appointed to public office again, and certainly didn't notify anyone on the council that I was interested. I was blessed to be elected both times I ran for mayor, and wouldn't trade those years of service and experience for anything. Although there were a few parts of the position that weren't all that enjoyable overall, I certainly love being mayor for the people of this great city. It was an honor for me to serve in that position. While I appreciate some people thinking of me in mayoral or councilman terms again, the rest of my career is to my community as a private citizen, an editor of this newspaper. It's time for others to step up. As I looked at the photos of my last day in the mayor's office that I saw today, I thought back on my feelings that day. When I closed the door for the mayor's office behind me for the final time, I left a piece of my heart there, and I knew I wouldn't return. That was 7 years ago, and in the years since, despite all of the conversations I have had with the late mayor and others in city government, and all the columns I've written about City Hall, I never returned to the mayor's office for any reason. I've been to City Hall, but never stepped inside that office. I'm not sure why, because I don't think I've intentionally avoided it. Maybe it's because behind that door is a ton of bittersweet memories that I don't want to disturb. That was written by Paul Osborne. Letters to the editor in this Decatur Tribune. Adding 900 more cars daily to Macon County's busiest intersection is a disaster waiting to happen. And this is letters to the editor. Dear editor, at the Decatur City Planning Commission meeting on September 3rd, Mr. Abuna of KLOA Incorporated presented Aldi's traffic study results. He stated under oath that Ash Avenue's westbound traffic averaged 10 to 12 cars per hour. The room exploded in laughter at this ludicrous statement. I live on Ash, and over four 15-minute time periods on September 4th to the 6th, I counted an average of 45 westbound and 51 eastbound cars on Ash. This equates to 180 westbound and 204 eastbound cars per hour from 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m., hardly rush hour traffic. On Saturday, September 6th, around 1 o'clock, 25 eastbound cars were waiting at the light at Ash and U.S. 51 to turn north or continue east. Imagine how long those turning west onto Ash from U.S. 51 will have to wait to make that immediate left turn into Aldi's parking lot, with 25 cars waiting to get through the intersection and unintentionally blocking the left turn entrance proposed by Aldi. Aldi's spokesman stated that they expected about 900 cars daily at this Aldi. The Herald and Review September 3rd editorial stated that traffic engineers hired by Aldi said that the traffic situation shouldn't get significantly worse because of the store. Adding 900 cars daily to already heavy traffic at the busiest intersection of Macon County is disaster waiting to happen at the portal to Houston Hills, Windsor Village, Shadow Lane, and Crest Haven subdivisions. Do Decatur officials anticipate problems? They included rezoning stipulations requiring developers to make intersection improvements deemed necessary if additional traffic generated by Aldi causes problems. Who will deem improvements necessary? How many traffic problems or accidents must occur to mandate improvements? How will pedestrians be affected by the proposed change of 3 lanes of traffic on Ash to 4 lanes without widening the road, but merely taking away parking spaces on the street that now act as a buffer between pedestrians and traffic on Ash Avenue? I truly fear for the safety of children who use Ash Avenue to walk to and from the two neighborhood schools. Ironically, on September 4th, I was at the intersection by the Aldi on Mount Zion Road. There was a massive multi-car accident there that required multiple emergency and police vehicles to block the road for over an hour. Is this a picture of what is to come at U.S. 51 and Ash Avenue? Aldi's consultants presented the commission inaccurate, misleading information. 5 planning commission members bought it. Let's hope the city council members show more common sense and not approve this proposed rezoning. That was written by Marilyn Dawson of Decatur, and that was an editorial in the Decatur Tribune. That's all we have time for today. This is Kathy signing off for Tuesday, the 22nd of September. Stay tuned for the second half of the Decatur News.